Hey, gaveling in this meeting of the Alaska State Legislative Council. Today is November 21, 2013, roughly 10 o'clock in the morning. We're meeting in the Anchorage LIO room 105 in our temporary facilities for the next year. First item on the agenda will be our roll call to establish a quorum. And I'd also note for members' benefit that since we do have members online, we've decided that it's better that we do all voting by roll call rather than by unanimous consent, just to be sure that we've got a quorum for all votes. So, Madam Secretary, would you please establish the quorum?
Representative Fennell.
I'm sorry, is that me?
It's very
last thing we knew, it was you.
I couldn't hear, Julie.
Yeah, no, we can barely hear you, Judy or Julie.
Can you hear me better now?
Perfect.
Yes, we can. Yeah.
Okay. Representative Gruenberg.
Here.
Representative Johnson.
Here.
Representative Pruitt. Representative Schultz. Representative Wilson.
Present.
Senator Huggins. Senator Coghill.
Here.
Senator Dunleavy. Senator Egan.
Present.
Senator Meyer.
Here.
Senator Stevens.
Here.
Representative Osterman. Senator Hoffman. Vice Chair Maticki.
Present.
Chair Hawker.
I am present. So, by that count, we do have a quorum to conduct business. As I noted before, we're all voting by roll call today simply because we do have members online, and it's important that we make sure we continue to acknowledge our continuing quorum. And I'd also like to welcome Senator Olson. Good to have you with us, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate the help.
Very happy to have you here. First item of business is the ratification of a charity event, which I have previously approved. That is the Alaska Arts and Cultural Foundation. The governor's awards for arts and humanities are officially sanctioned by the Legislative Council. My staff has reviewed these organizations, and in compliance with Alaska statute, they are in fact a recognized 501c3 in good standing, which allows us to sanction them as a sanctioned charitable event. So I'll be looking for a motion for that. Representative Johnson, sir.
Mr. Chair, I move the Legislative Council ratify the following charity events, which was previously sanctioned by the Legislative Council Chair in accordance with AS 24.60.480A2B. The Alaska Governor's Award for the Arts and Humanities benefiting the Alaska Arts and Cultural Foundation.
This one right up here.
The question before the committee is the ratification of the Alaska Governor's Awards for the Arts and Humanities benefiting the Alaska Arts and Humanities Cultural Foundation. Is there objection before we vote?
I just had a question.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So we're sanctioning the governor's awards for the arts and humanities, but it's in behalf of the Arts and Culture Foundation?
Yes, that is correct. And what sanctioning does is what we are actually doing is ratifying an event that I have already sanctioned in accordance with statute. And what it does is it allows this event to be attended by a legislator being sponsored by a lobbyist and receive a gift to attend it. We're not in any way sanctioning or endorsing or an organization or an event in particular. Hearing see no more objections. Madam Secretary, would you call our roll, please?
Representative Chenault?
Yes.
Representative Gruenberg?
Yes.
Representative Johnson?
Yes.
Representative Pruitt?
Yes.
Representative Stoltz?
Yes.
Representative Wilson?
Yes.
Senator Huggins? Senator Coghill?
Yes.
Senator Dunleavy? Senator Egan?
Yes.
Senator Meyer?
Yes.
Senator Stevens? Vice Chair Maticki?
Yes.
Chair Hawker?
Yes. Madam Secretary, would you announce the roll?
10 yeas and zero nays.
So on a vote of 10 yeas and zero nays, the Governor's Awards for the Arts and Humanities event has been ratified. Next thing we go into is a bit of substantive business here. If I could ask Bob O'Neill to come forward, please, and join us. Just in case anyone hasn't noticed, we're in a different location than we've been in for 20 years, and Mr. O'Neill here is the, fair to say, the project manager for the project going on with the LIO renovations. He is an employee of Pfeffer Development and has coordinated all this. And as we go into this next question for this committee, I want to actually personally thank Bob and your people for doing such an incredible job of getting this building into condition. Folks that didn't see it, where we're starting here 2.5 weeks ago was an empty warehouse. And through Bob and their people, they have turned it into all these offices in about 2.5 weeks. Pretty incredible job, and likewise, all the plan and work that they're going to be putting across next door at the end of the day is in Bob's hands. So he's, you know, we appreciate what you're doing here. Wow. And I'd also be remiss, while I'm just having 2 seconds on the floor, I think everyone in this building knows how much work Julie Lucky put into making this project happen. And I don't know how I'm ever going to pay her back for that, but I'm going to try to give her about a 2-month Christmas holiday. But anyway, thank you both.
Well, thank you, and it's a pleasure to be here this morning. The purpose of me coming here to talk with you this morning is we have an opportunity as we move forward into the construction of the building to talk with you about furnishing the building upon completion. And I've brought a couple slides just to give you an idea of sort of where we're heading, but for the most part, I think it's just an opportunity to sort of talk about a process that we'd like to offer you and engage with you in. So with that said, the building being rebuilt is being standardized in a way that I think is really unique for you guys, in that all of the offices are going to be the same, and the missing piece in that is the furnishings for the office. And so what I wanted to talk to you about this morning is the process that you can choose to go through or not to complete the build-out of the building with the furnishing. So with that said, I have a floor plans up on the wall for those of you on the phone. I apologize, but these are the floor plans for the remodeled building. On the ground floor, we have the large conference spaces, and in those spaces, we've laid out several different options for use of that space, but for those of you that have seen the NANA building, it's fairly similar in that regard, that it's very flexible open space that could be set up like this room, or it could be set up in a number of different ways, depending on your selections of furnishings.
And actually, Bob, if I might just put an introductory comment here as well. In the previous meeting, when we moved forward with this project, we had talked, and I will note that it was in the executive session, but we had talked about furnishings being the last item that were on the list that we would be back and revisiting in an open session of the legislature, since it's really not part of a financial negotiation. It's more of a contract matter that really needs to be discussed in public forum. So we deferred that to this next meeting, as well as having an opportunity for the project managers to put together this process proposal to think about. And it's just that, you know, Bob will continue to explain it, but anybody that watched the furnishings move in and out, our furnishings are pretty much in the same condition the building's in. And anyway, Bob, floor's back to you.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I'd agree with that statement that, you know, in seeing the building emptied out, we think it's a great opportunity to start over and really enhance the work environment for all the employees in the building as well.
So we'll talk a little bit about some of the sort of newer technologies out there as we go through today. But kind of taking a step back, process-wise, we've done this for a large number of single-tenant buildings. And what we see in the process of getting through the design, getting into construction, nobody really wants to think about furnishing out the building to get closer to the end. But what we found is it takes about a year-long process to get to the point that you actually have furniture in the building. So where we're at today is we're about to start construction. About a year from now, we'll be completing construction. So we're in the time frame where it's really important to start thinking about this process and the decisions that can be made going forward. So with that said, the opportunity here is to standardize not only the office spaces, but the furnishing within them, and also provide for flexibility in the future. So we know that in the staff areas, sometimes there's one staff member, sometimes there might be three. Each staff has different needs as far as storage, different wants as far as their work environment. So what we tend to think about is, given what's available in the market today, we'd like to engage in a process with you to go through that and present to you a number of options, and then come back again where we can go through a bid process and get to a total final cost, and then let you make the decision whether you want to move forward at that point. So really what we're proposing is a two-step process where we start with engaging you and the designers to come up with basically a scope of work in which they work with you to come up with a number of selections that we can go then out into the market and compete and get a competitive price for the fit out of the entire building. So with that said, I'll see if I can get to my next slide. Oh, maybe.
How about there? If you scroll down.
Yeah. Well, at least thinking about it.
Yeah.
So the other thing, while I'm waiting for our technology to kind of kick in, is part of the process is also the conference room spaces, and we have conference rooms, both the public conference rooms on the first floor, and then we have conference rooms up through the building. So part of what we do besides the furniture is we engage with technology folks and with your IT team to fit out those conference rooms. So part of our proposal would be to go through that process and identify specific pieces of technology that would complete the fit out of those spaces. Much like in this room, video conferencing, audio, all of that sort of stuff.
Cameras,
microphones. And we've done that in a large number of office buildings, and typically in those cases it's more like boardrooms. But again, using Nana building as an example, the first floor of that space is a very, very large conference room. It can be figured in a number of different ways. And in that case, we have three projection screens, three projectors, what's happening there? Cameras, and an audio-visual system. On each floor of that building, we also have conference rooms, much like this building, which have video conferencing and all of that. So the technology piece of these buildings is a really important piece to consider as well. And so what we're proposing is to engage with a company called Chariot Group, who does this for a lot of office tenants in town. And I believe they've worked with you guys in the past. But to come up with, again, a set of specifications that we can put out to bid to finish out those conference rooms. All right, got my next slide. Not quite sure how we got there, but that's terrific.
What this slide is showing is a whole bunch of different parts and pieces, and one of the things that we were thinking about in kind of getting this together for you is that what you really want in these spaces is standardization but also flexibility. So depending on the number of staff you have, depending on how you want to set up your office, basically we provide a kit of parts that you can arrange in different ways depending on storage needs, depending on staff needs. So this sheet gives you an example. One of the things that we've been looking at, which is getting very popular now, is sit-to-stand desks. So they actually elevate at your control so that you can work either standing up or sitting down. Some people have even gone so far as to put treadmills with them so you can actually walk and work. So there's a whole bunch of different options with that, but that's becoming really, really popular these days. There's a variety of different work surfaces that can go together with that, variety of different storage configurations, including lateral files, vertical storage, even coat and boot racks that can go as part of a piece of picture. So it gives you a whole lot of flexibility in what's in the marketplace now as far as setting up these offices for yourselves and your staff to provide a really inviting work environment. There's, you know, chairs, which is a real big deal. We've been through this on a number of projects, and in fact, at one point, we'll probably come in with about a dozen different chairs, and you can all sit test them and pick which ones you like. There's also some soft seating areas and some smaller and larger staff meeting areas. So this sheet is just sort of a real generic first look at all the different kit of parts. And what we're not talking about is systems furniture that requires, you know, walls and dividers to hold them up. All of the stuff that we're talking about would be freestanding in the office so that you can move it out of the office if you don't need it. It's easy to store.
Pick and choose.
Pick and choose and configure as you see fit and as things change over time within those offices.
And I would also interject here, Bob, it's the concept that you're bringing forward as you're talking about this is you would not be working blindly, but this would be the requirements definition here would be done in coordination with our LAA staff team who would be working with you in identifying what you want to go forward with.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And, in fact, that's why we try to allocate a year for this process is because the first step is really an engagement process where we go through basically office by office within the building and with a select group, and in your case it would be this group, to identify needs, standard, appearance. And what we do is we put together a large bid package, and I actually brought an example of that too. But it turns out to be about a 60 or 70-page document that we can then put out into the marketplace and get competitive bids on. So we specify every part and piece, every nut and bolt, make sure we've got everything covered in a way that allows a competitive bid. So we aren't so specific to say it can only be this brand or only this type, but we put together a set of standards, both graphically like you're seeing right now, but also in written form with counts to say this many chairs, this many tables, this many this or that, so that we can get that competitive bid, and we're actually comparing apples to apples at the end of the day. What this sheet shows is just a quick, we put this together yesterday actually, so it's a pretty quick shot, but just a graphic representation of how these different parts and pieces could come together in several different configurations. So it just gives you a basic idea of different layout options, different opportunities. But again, it's very generic, so, you know, we tried to keep it essentially black and white. We did put a little bit of color in just to get a little bit of differentiation in there, but just to give you a basic idea of how these parts and pieces might come together. The next slide is just a meeting room slide, and again, this is combining both the furniture and the technology, which we highly recommend. For example,
large tables like the ones shown, boardroom tables, the tables you guys are sitting at. What we really try to do is get all the technology up through the legs from floor boxes, so we want to do that during construction so we don't end up with sort of what we got here today, which is cores running across the floor and tape over the carpet. So it's another reason why we want to gauge it early in this process, is so that we can do some things during construction that make all of this come together at the end in a clean fit, so that all of this stuff fits together, works, is tested. So when you move in, you're just bringing a box of your stuff, and that's, you know, basically what it comes down to. Everything's there, ready to go, waiting for you. I think that was probably it for the slides that I put together on that. So just to summarize, what we're suggesting is a two-stage process where you engage us through a design sort of contract to come up with a standard package for the entire building of all of the parts and pieces. And then we come back to you after we've put that out to the marketplace and say, here's what the cost for that package is, here's all the bids, it's all open book, and at that point you make a decision whether you want to go ahead and purchase that equipment and the furnishings or not. And the community understands that when we put these packages out, there's always an option at the end to say, no, we'll stick with what we got. So it's an opportunity, it's an offer, but it's not a requirement by any means that in the end you're committed to anything beyond the time that we put into it to get to this.
And then back from our side, at the end of the day, we're going to have furnishings, and it really became apparent, I think, to all of us much more so than before we had moved over here. And then, Pam, I don't know if you want to comment on this, but we discovered some pretty awful things about our furniture, basically. I mean, people that have been over there had been seeing it. It had been the hodgepodge for years, assembled by individuals at their own sort of will and whim. And, you know, we move it once, and I'd say probably about half of what was over there is really not suitable for putting back in place at this time. So, you know, we will need furnishings one way or another. And as far as procuring of these services, if talked with our legal folks, and you know, we have several avenues of procuring this proposal service, I just want to call it, the requirements definition and proposing process. And what I would like to ask the committee to do today is would be asking for the council to authorize us as me as the chair, but on behalf of the committee and working with LAA, to negotiate with these folks under one of our procurement options for them to engage them to come back to us with these proposals. As I've talked with your principals, I think in basing it on the costs, and please, Bob, affirm for me that you did the same thing for the folks over at NANA, and that over there, the cost of getting your design people and they make a living out of doing these kind of designs and writing these procurements. It's estimated to be a procurement that's going to be probably between $75,000 and $100,000.
Yeah, I'd say that's correct based on our prior experience, a fair range.
And so the motion that I would be bringing forward here would be authorizing me to negotiate with the, and basically just broadly, so whether we decide that at the end of the day it's a contract directly with Chariot or whether it's through you or whatever the appropriate mechanism is, that we've got the authority to negotiate to put together a bid package for furnishings. So with that, I'm going to throw it open to conversations from the committee. Representative Stoltz.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll identify myself as, I guess, the poor Chugiak Valley cousin who I was happy to have just the surplus furniture, and I commend Mr. George and my other staff for digging it up from the state surplus. I'm getting a little nervous about another aspect. We're having kind of a big furniture Tupperware party here, and we don't have any options. I don't know what's going to be thrown at us. Where we are right now, I'm even more trepidation about jumping into a furniture contract some of these things I thought were going to be coming back to us for further discussion. I guess I'm just call me gun shy, and I'm going to be I'm just going to be casting a protest vote. And I'll just leave it there, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Representative Stoltz.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Coghill. Or excuse me, sir. We serve together as representatives. Senator Coghill.
Thank you. There was a lot of furnishings, and if there's some value there, are we going to quantify that? What do we do with it? Maybe Pam can tell us, but is that does that go to surplus auction? Just how do we deal with it? Is there value to be gained is what I'm looking for.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Pam Varney, Executive Director. Senator Coghill, through the chair, we have identified quite a bit of furniture right now that we are sending to surplus. We are storing some furniture, but we have really not made a large purchase of furniture, you know, for probably, you know, 20 years. We've piecemealed some things, but anything that is worth saving after our temporary space here, if we do get this new furniture, we will look throughout the state if there is anything that is worth saving, sending it out to our other offices, sending it to Juneau, and then those things that we do not want that we think that maybe some other state agencies might want, we will send that to state surplus. So that is our plan.
Senator Coghill, just trying to figure out how to recoup any kind of value, you know, and you know, it's the anchor's decision, in my view. But there is a lot of, this is to the chairman, there is a lot of legislators that have taken their office account and put into their office. Should we require some office participation or, I guess, since they did it with their office account, that's their furniture. They actually can travel with that. Isn't that true?
It is owned by the legislator. It's not the state. So
I guess that answers that question. So I think
we can also talk to that from another direction, that this concept includes that if a legislator wishes to furnish his own office, that the, you know, should we proceed with a procurement, should we determine to execute a procurement, the concept behind the furnishing packages, the kit of furnishings, is that individual legislators who choose to furnish their own office in their own manner with their own furnishings could still do that. But what we would have on, arguably at the end of the day, we would have on hand sufficient furnishings that if that legislator leaves office and someone comes in, we've still got a kit of furnishings that can go right into that office for the succeeding legislator.
And that was going to be one of my points, is there's some basics that just have to be there, right? And then I know from my experience, and certainly Pam has this experience, that it's quite a shuffle when new legislators come in. So certainly in all LIOs, you know, they want to move things around. So I guess I'll just be watching for how do we navigate that. But certainly listening to the Anchorage legislators on that one.
I appreciate your support there, because, again, this is, I guess it's fair to say this is a necessary evil and part of a, and shit, I've got freaking media back there that's going to quote me calling it a necessary evil, but it's an essential part of a real estate development process. And I've done big buildings before. I was with Arctic Slope Regional Corporation when we built that great big building in Midtown. And I think the biggest challenge in the entire process was at the end of the day sitting down and work. It wasn't the building, it was the furnishings. You suddenly, you know, you really find what's involved in the decision-making process, how complex it is, and you discover really quickly, gosh, you can't go that alone, and you really do need the professionals to help you work through it.
Mr. Chairman, one last comment,
Senator,
and then I'll shut up for a little bit. I agree with you on that. Since you mentioned media, one of the things that I was thinking about when he was presenting was quite often media will use hallways or conference rooms. Whatever we do in the hallways or whatever we do, we should try to make as much room available for them, both technology-wise and otherwise. So you just in our LIO here in Anchorage, quite often we were just jammed into the hallway with cameras tripping over each other. maybe we should make some room for them. That's all.
I believe that's been accommodated.
We have accommodated that in the design of the right. New floor plans.
We put spikes on the walls and everything.
Mr. Representative
Wilson, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Excuse me. One thing I'd like to comment is that, you know, people may think that just because we have items in storage that they're top-notch items. When you go down, I know from my offices when we're not in Juneau, some of the things that you have to look at and pick from are not very good shape. And got lots of scratches on them, some of the veneers coming off the side and whatnot. And so it's not exactly easy to go down and pick something when you really want it to look nice because you've got constituents coming to see it, and yet there's not nice to pick from. And so, you know, some of the stuff that is available here that is what we can do, I know because I've seen when you move a desk sometimes, it's so heavy that you move it and the legs are starting to wobble and come off and stuff like that. So I just want to make the comment because the people that are listening, and I just want them to realize that just because we have excess and that it's stored somewhere doesn't mean that it's high-quality product always. So I just want to make that comment.
Mr. Chair? Mr. Chair?
And who is requesting the floor?
Max.
Representative Grunberg, sir.
Thank you. Just a question to clarify. The $75,000 to $100,000 that you're seeking authorization for, that is to hire these folks to advise us on obtaining the furniture, right?
And I'd ask Bob to just say that or repeat it himself so that he can very clearly explain to you what it is.
The advisory role includes putting together a procurement package. So at the end of this process, we would have, you know, a 30 to 70 page document that would allow us to go to the market to actually get final quotes.
Yeah. This is not to buy the furniture itself. It's to hire you to help us on the thing.
That's correct, and it's actually predominantly the architects and interior designers who are working on the building, KPB architects, that we would retain to put this package together. And part of that is, of course, the dialogue on what you want.
Thank you very much.
Representative Pruitt.
You may not be able to answer this, and that's okay. Do you have an idea of what we're talking about would be the end result and the total cost, potentially? I mean, so far we've dealt with what, you know, the interior designers and those, but what are we looking at? I mean, I don't know if part of the discussion on whether we should go forward is whether or not we're comfortable with the potential end result, I think.
Yeah, and I can certainly understand the question, and it's a little bit difficult, but based on our experience, I'd say between all of the furnishings for this size building and all the technology components for the conference rooms and the public spaces, you could be in the $1.4 to $1.8 million range.
And then follow up.
And if I could actually, but you know, ballpark that for our unique technology requirements?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, we actually did.
Separate it? I mean.
Oh, what the separate numbers
yeah.
are? We estimated about $200,000 to $400,000 in technology alone.
I was going to ask that. Thank
you. Oh, sorry about that, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Great minds think alike.
Yeah, I was going to ask that component. I don't have another one because that was actually where I was going to go with the next. So.
Representative Johnson, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have a procurement department. I don't see anyone, you know, jumping up and down saying, yeah, this is a great idea, or no, it's not. So I kind of like to hear from our guys. Is it something that we have done before? Is it something we're capable of doing?
Are you in over your heads? Where are you? You know, what are your thoughts from a state procurement process? We buy stuff all the time. So I just want to know if it's really something we want to take outside the building or if we can handle it inside before making any kind of decision. So someone can address that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I think a lot of this work is by the architects, and we don't have an architect on staff. So that part of it we have had outside architects do before. The procurement, yes, but they're going to come up with, you know, the actual design and the numbers for us. We certainly could take that information and then, you know, have Tina Strong do the procurement. So that part, yes, we can handle, but the actual work by the architects, no, we cannot handle that in-house. It needs to be done outside.
Representative Johnson.
And I guess my question is, do we run afoul of any procurement? I'm assuming that once the bid proposals are done, our procurement people will take over and handle the bids and the bid evaluations and all of that. So will that be handled in-house as well, or are we looking at contracting that out as well?
Okay. If I might, at this point, the authority that we're seeking here is to basically to negotiate and determine what would be the process forward.
Mr. Chairman, if I could, as an editorial comment, I would encourage us to use our in-house people as much as we can when it comes to the evaluation. Other than that,
absolutely.
That's in the future, I understand.
And I have talked with Mr. Gardner about this as recently as this morning, and his comment back to me was, look, there's a myriad of procurement routes available to us. It's a matter of picking the course that ends up being basically our best desire that gives us the best execution, and we're looking for the authority to keep working with PAM, with our legal department, to determine that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Could I just
Mr. O'Neill, sir?
One thing on that. In our experience, having the same architects that are working on the building do the furniture work is an added advantage because of the coordination, especially with the technology, but with the building systems, the building wiring, all of that stuff. So the entire design team that's working on the building also engages in the process of the ultimate furnishings, layout, and design, so that at the end of the day, it's an integrated system that's installed, and there's a single point of contact and a single responsibility for that. And we've seen it go a number of different ways, but where we've seen problems is where individual parts and pieces are procured and there's not a single person responsible. So there disputes arise over who's responsible for doing the wiring to the furnishings, things like that. So I just wanted to point that out as an advantage.
Representative Johnson, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, Mr. Chairman. That is exactly my point. I want someone that is accountable to the legislature for the next 20 or 30 years, not someone that walks away and when the building's done and the contract's assigned and the final check. So I want people that are accountable, that work for us, very much involved in this process. So that's kind of the point and the direction that I'm going to be looking for. But I understand we're not there yet, but I just want to clarify that in the future, those decisions.
And that's a good point because, as you know, a contractor's warranty goes basically for, you know, a year after a project's completed. Anything that's an issue, they have to deal with.
Right.
And in our case, frankly, the way this has been said, we have no financial exposure whatsoever. But what we do have is the comeback that the building has to function.
Right.
And we have no financial exposure on the project itself. But we, again, if it's not working, and we... You know, you buy a suite of furniture that doesn't work with the way the building was, that's our problem, not somebody else's. Very, very good point.
Mr. Chair.
Is that Senator Michicki?
It is.
Senator Michicki, sir.
You know, I don't really disagree with anything I've heard today other than the fact that I do agree with the previous speaker. We need to use our internal resources whenever possible. One consideration might be to split off those. We identify the needs for the furniture that's required, and perhaps we order some internally, and it's just something worth considering. But I think it is worthy to comment that, you know, I'm sitting in my remote office right now with hand-me-downs,
my office in Juneau is filled with hand-me-downs, and I think it's sort of a badge of honor for folks. I don't think we should have an expectation. And again, it's not necessarily referring to this current project. I think we should get full usage out of our state resources. So the idea that we have brand new shiny furniture in each office is something that we should guard against, in my opinion.
And it's a point well noted, which is where putting this package together allows us to inventory, and working with LAA to inventory what we have and where we want to look at new furnishings and where we don't need to look at new furnishings. That's, again, why LAA would be involved with the requirements work being done by a professional design services firm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And actually, my staff just reminded me as well a point about when we go out ourselves and buy brand-new furniture. There was a bunch of new furniture purchased at a very nice LIO facilities in Eagle River and Wasilla, and you know, we bring in the furniture, and our IS guys had to go out and start drilling holes in the furniture in order to wire the computer technology. You know, it's a no-win situation. But is there further discussion? I guess hearing see none. Representative Johnson, would you make a motion for us?
Thank you. I move that Ledge Council authorize the chairman to negotiate for professional design service for an integrated furnishings package for the Anchorage Legislative Information Office not to exceed $100,000.
Okay. The question before the committee is authorizing the chairman to negotiate for professional design services not to exceed $100,000. Madam Secretary, if you would call the roll, please.
Representative Chenault. Representative Gruenberg.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Pruitt. Yes. Representative Stoltz.
No.
Representative Wilson.
Yes.
Senator Huggins. Senator Coghill.
Yes.
Senator Dunleavy. Senator Egan.
Yes.
Senator Meyer.
Yes.
Senator Stevens. Vice Chair Machicki.
Yes.
Chair Hawker.
Yes.
Nine yeas and one nay.
So, thank you, Madam Secretary. So on a vote of nine yea and one nay, the motion carries. Thank you. We'll continue to do the work, keep the committee informed, and, again, keep moving us forward with this project and proposal. Thanks, Bob. Appreciate your time today. And I'd also like to extend on your behalf, I guess, and we haven't talked about this by any means, but any legislator who has a question, concern, or issue about this project is certainly
more than welcome.
I believe your door is wide open to sit down and talk to them at any level of detail that's involved in the project, anything from desks and tables to financing.
Yep. Anything you guys need, just let me know. I'm more than happy to help.
Mr. Chairman, if I
could, Representative Johnson,
before
sir.
Before we move on for this, and I want to encourage, and what I like about this is that we are integrating the furniture and the technology, but I also would like to take a forward-looking approach with utility corridors into those that becomes available. So as new technology grows, that we're not redesigning everything so that we build them for the future as much as possible. They're going to be in this a long time, and it's going to have function for many, many years. And as we know, technology changes, so I'd like to have a forward vision look at when we start designing these units and packages. So,
yeah, absolutely, and we take that into account even in the basic building design. So we try to provide the most flexibility to anticipate future improvements in technology, particularly in meeting room spaces like this. Where it's really important to provide as much flexibility as possible as technology changes.
Thank you.
And Representative Johnson, I would also note while the process is just beginning to get underway at the previous Ledge Council meeting, I believe, we sought and were granted the authority to pursue the change of approach on this building into some form of a lease purchase so that at the end of the day it would be a purchased building with when the project was completed or sometime down the line. Again, right now, we've been rather tied up in working the interim end of the project and letting the professionals do the work they need to do. And frankly, I don't think we as a committee are not exactly set up to run a building construction process. But once we see and we've got something to work with, I am continuing to work and just have conversations, explore conversations with the building's owners about their willingness or interest in moving in that direction. And I can only say that they are very willing to sit down and talk to us.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Bob. Thank you. Appreciate you being here. Okay, what I'm going to do at the moment is I'm going to roll down the calendar and pick up the legislator allowance accounts because that's a topical item, and I know some folks at this table have got places to go and places to be. I spent a good chunk of the summer doing research on these accounts after the change was made by the previous legislative council that created a compensatory allowance system. I think we all know what that was. Everyone got a check instead of having to turn in receipts. I distributed a very arcane and technical memo done by Deloitte Tax. This is one of the world's leading tax and accounting firms. But in summarizing that memo, we've really got three options ahead of us, and specifically in that this committee does not have authority to change legislators' base salaries. It's, you know, that's a statutory matter. And actually, two other things. One, I would note that we've got Representative Garrow with us, and we have Representative Guttenberg, I believe, online. Representative Guttenberg, are you online? Rep. Guttenberg?
I am.
Okay, good to have you with us.
Thank you.
We really have three choices in this matter in front of us. Our statute authorizes the existence of allowance accounts, which is basically expense allowance accounts. And it is that, and if I'll cite from that, it's cite 24.10.110, additional allowances, and that's in addition to the salary of a legislator. In addition, each member of the legislature is entitled to an annual allowance prescribed in accordance with AS 39.23 for postage, stationery, stenographic services, and other expenses. I think it's pretty clear by that statute, and I'm not a lawyer. I don't play one on TV, and I don't pretend to be one. In fact, I'm usually rather critical of attorneys. That allowance was intended to be office expenses. It was not intended to be compensation to the legislature, no matter how that might be structured. And even though our allowance accounts have been structured since I've been in the legislature to have some element of compensatory nature, I think it was a real push interpreting the law in that manner. So, okay, my staff has informed me that we're having a technical problem somewhere in our own telecommunications system. So I will take a brief at ease until that gets resolved. Les. Okay, we're back on the record. Just also for the record, Madam Secretary, this is the first committee meeting that's been held in this temporary space. So I, again, congratulations to all my tech guys who we don't see who are working in the rooms behind us who are making this work and actually making this whole thing come together. And they've only had like 2 weeks to set up the complete move from the old facility to this one at the moment. So congratulations, tech guys. But getting back to what we have, we've really got three options in front of us that are legal in accordance with Internal Revenue Service pronouncement. And when I say legal, it is very clearly we can have an allowance account where it is what we call fully accountable. That is, you set an amount that people can have. They have to turn receipts into the LAA. LAA pays for those receipts, and as long as they are a legitimate legislative business expense, they get paid up to the amount. We have to treat everyone the same doing that. We could also have an account that is a non-accountable account, which is what we were given for this year by the previous legislative council. That's where they decide just to give us an amount of money. It's handed to us at the beginning of the year. It's treated as taxable income. It has withholding against it. It's compensation to us. And whatever we do with the net amount we receive requires no more reporting back to the state or otherwise. It's just in our hands to use as we will. Again, non-accountable account resulting in taxable income. Those two are very clear. It took me a while working with Deloitte Tax to see if there were any other really viable options out there for us, and really wanted to see how much latitude we had to give individual legislators the ability to choose, say, between those two, fully accountable or non-accountable, which was a little bit more like what we had before the universal rule was in place a year ago. And that's really, it falls on the concept of what we call cafeteria benefits plans. And in this case, after a lot of professional research by some, you know, literally the some of the best people in the nation, they've come down and concluded that, frankly, the IRS hasn't ruled on whether we could do that or not. But under the, and they have not issued the regulations that they proposed to deal with the, it was 2007 that the cafeteria concept really was evolved at the IRS. They proposed regulations. They haven't finalized them yet. But those regulations, if finalized, would probably be construed to preclude the ability of individual legislators to choose between accountable, non-accountable. So on a long-term going forward basis, choosing to allow individual legislators to make their choices probably, it's pretty, at best it's going to be an uphill battle and unworkable in the long range into the future. And particularly when you cast this in light of our statutory authority to have allowance accounts, I don't see personally anywhere in that statute that allows us to have any form of a compensatory allowance account. I think the fully accountable is, in fact, really our only viable route forward for being proper, for properly implementing that statute. Again, I think it provides for accountability, transparency, and reportability for state funds. So what I'd intended to do today, and I distributed, of course, the memo and the options here to the committee last week, is putting a motion on the floor that would direct that LAA rewrite the allowance policy as a fully accountable policy. So with that, I'd throw the conversation open for conversation. I know Representative Guerra, who's in the audience, wants to testify. Perhaps this would be your opportunity, Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Representative Hawker, members of the committee. I do hope the legislature changes the office account policy to one that our accountants and attorneys have said is legal. The problem with the current policy is roughly $1,000 goes into our retirement accounts out of our office account. And we have an office account statute that says money should be spent on office expenses. Since last December, I've said that's wrong. Many other legislators have felt the same way. So that, I think, has to be changed. The part of the current policy that says a third of the money goes to the federal government, that's $300,000 that gets sent to the federal government because it's taxable. That doesn't seem smart. The public should have a right to know what we spend our office account money on, and that makes sense. That's not the policy under the current system. And at the end of the year, if you have money left over, obviously it should lapse to the general fund. I think that's something that the legislature has made a mistake on over the years. That money should lapse to the legislature, not come back, not be left with us. So because of transparency, the public deserves that, because they should know where our money is going, because money from office account, money from the office account should not go into our retirement accounts. I would also hope that the committee would adopt the policy that says we report our expenses to the Legislative Affairs Agency so the public can see what they are, that whatever money is not spent goes back to the general fund. Certainly rural legislators are going to have higher expenses than those of us in the bigger cities. And obviously none of the money go into our retirement accounts. That is the plan, I think, that most legislators support.
You're saying already that you agree with the motion I'm about to put forward.
Representative Hawker, that's the one that I think should be adopted. I guess it doesn't matter that it's happening now. Obviously, I would have liked it to happen earlier, but I appreciate it.
In response
it.
To that point, point out that it was the previous legislative council that made that decision, not the people seated here today.
Sure.
And that policy, as it was put in place, necessarily lasted for 1 year, and we are taking action today as soon as it's practicable for us in time to make sure that we implement the new policy as soon as it's possible to implement a new policy.
Mr. Chair, I don't think I have anything else to add. I think that's the way the legislature should go. I think that's the way the public would want us to go, and I think that's the way most legislators would want us to go.
Thank you, Representative Guerra. Members of the committee. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I want to thank you for actually getting some assistance from some professional tax people. I think the decision that was made in the previous Ledge Council was made somewhat without appropriate information. I don't think we had all of the everything we needed to make the right decision. And the decision then was to offer flexibility to a legislator and kind of let them do it on their own. With this newfound information, I have no doubt that the direction we're going in is appropriate. I do have one additional question, and maybe this is for LAA. Are we going to need additional staff to administer 60 accounts? And at what point? And I hope the answer is no.
Hello there. Would
not
you
put words in your mouth?
Would you put yourself on the record?
I would. For the record, my name is Beska Geary. I am the finance manager for Legislative Affairs Agency. Through the chair, Representative Johnson, no, we would not need extra staff. We have 4 people working in the accounting office, and we handled accountable plans in the past. We can do it again, and I have no doubt that we can handle the workload.
Well asked. Thank you, Representative Johnson. Senator Meyer, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, Mr. Chairman, frankly, I don't care either way, accountable or non-accountable, because I've always exceeded the allotment that I'm given, the $20,000. I guess my question is, shouldn't the Senate have twice as much as the House? The large district is twice as large. Because what I've found, I know this is going to go over like a lead balloon with you guys over there, but what I have found being in the Senate is that when you do a mailing and you got twice as many people to mail to, it's going to cost you twice as much. And that's how I usually exceed my allotment is in the mailings. And each mailing, I think, for a Senate district, which, again, is twice the size of a House district, $7,000-$8,000. So you send out 2 mailings, and we usually try to do one at the beginning of the year and one at the end of the year. You've already used up pretty much your whole allotment. So, Mr. Chairman, I guess I see some savings by just, having the House be 10,000 and the Senate be 20. Now, again, I know I'll have some disagreement on that, and now that I'm in the Senate, it's easy for me to say this. The other question is when you do take the lump sum and you keep track of your own expenses, then you can put it on your income tax and get that money back anyway. So, I mean, in a way, you're still tax protected. It is an extra step now because you have to turn your receipts into to your staff who then turns it in to you. So it isn't quite as efficient doing the accountable, but certainly I have no problem doing that. Like I said, we exceed the amount given to us every year anyway. I'm just still a little curious how we ended up 16 and 20 and not 10 and 20, Mr. Chairman.
To both your points, Senator Meyer from the chair, I wasn't part of this council when the rates were established, and it's certainly something that could be revisited at any time. It's well within the purview of this council to consider that. It's not something that I was prepared to bring up today, but it's something that certainly could be revisited in the future. You know, we could also give, House members, whatever they're getting their 16, if that's what's appropriate, maybe we need to increase it for senators. I don't know. You know, that balance works both ways. But I'd certainly be willing to talk about that. A point on the financial efficiency, however, is even when taken as a non-accountable plan as personal income then spent and then arguably getting a tax deduction on your Form 2106, which is employee business expenses, there's a adjusted gross income hurdle that, and I think it's either 3 or 6% that has to be exceeded before you can get any claim of those employee business expenses. So there is a built-in inefficiency there that you absolutely, totally, and completely lose a portion of that allowance account depending upon whatever your personal adjusted gross income might be.
And then, Mr. Chairman, I guess the only other question I'd have is I mean, I would agree that the cafeteria approach does seem like it's going to go away in the near future, so I think that option should be off the table. But why not give the legislators a choice, you know, going accountable or not accountable?
You phrased that as a question, so as the chair, I would respond as through myself as the chair responding as an individual legislator. Yeah, I don't see where we really have the authority to create allowance accounts that are in fact compensatory. In that we do not have that clear authority in statute. The statute really talks about an expense account that is for X, Y, and Z things. It's silent on that being administrated through additional compensation when there is no accounting requirement to come back to. No one is required to be accountable for the money they receive, so you don't know whether you spend it on business or not. And likewise, and then we do have a separate legal statute that defines what our compensation is, which does not talk to the fact that your compensation is your salary plus an abiding allowance account. That's me, but I also know that our council, and I didn't put it in the packet here, but a year ago and subsequently, our legal guys have said, you know, I'll use the non-legal term, it's squishy at best. And it's just not the place I want to go personally. I want to be crystal clear, absolutely accountable, and within the letter of the law. If legislative salaries need to be adjusted, we have a salary commission led by former Senator Halford, and that's his purview. We have handed off that responsibility to an outside party. Representative Wilson, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I like the fully accountable plan, and for me, actually, I get more bang for my buck when I don't have to, when it comes to me, then already so much is taken out for taxes, and so you don't have as much. It's not the full amount by a long shot. And so I like it. I never had a problem. I keep all my receipts anyway. And I just think that the money goes further that way. All you have to do is just spend something and hand it back in, and then they
and Jessica's got a file with your name on it over there.
And so it's not that difficult for me anyway, and because I always keep track of it at home. So I think it makes the money go further because you have more in the long run by quite almost a third. And so that helps a lot because our expenses are quite high depending on what we do and what has to be replaced and what has to be ordered for everything. So anyway, I like the first fully accountable plan.
Thank you very much, Representative Wilson. Representative Johnson, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was always one of those that took it split for convenience for myself because if I wanted to run to Costco or find a vendor locally. And I found that most of the vendors that I deal with, especially mailings and things like that, would bill the state. The crew that really never happened to me. My concern was that I couldn't get anyone to bill me. They wanted cash up front. But I found most of the vendors more than able, so that's the reason I took it split, so I could pay for it and get reimbursed. I found the response of the accounting department very quick. I never had a vendor call me up all day, running late. So I'm especially comfortable now that I've had an experience with the where they just send the bill to the LAA. My concern was my credit rating and all the stuff that if I had to pay it and it got, you know, lost in this vortex. So I wanted to be accountable for that myself. But since working with it on the split account and seeing how efficient they were when the bills were paid, and once again, no one ever called me and said you're 30 days late or anything. It was just fairly instant. And I want to compliment your department for doing that. So I'm more comfortable now. And that's the only reason I took the split in the first place was to protect my own. If I ordered something, I wanted to make sure it wasn't 60, 90 days. Some of our state agencies don't function as well. I get compulsive. The state owes me $1 million and they're 90 days late. And how do I get my money? And I didn't want you know, my printing company calling me and saying, hey, you're 90 days late. You know, we're tacking this on. But I found it very efficient. They're very efficient with what they do. So I'm really comfortable now with the account the way it is. I'm very complimentary of you guys. That's why I don't want you to get bogged down because I want to continue that. I never want a credit call. Because I placed an order and done something for a mail, and I said 60 days later, you haven't paid it. I haven't found that to be the case, so that was the reason I took the split account in the first place, was to make sure I could protect my own credit rating. And but I'm very comfortable with the performance of the accounting department. I feel very comfortable now with the current.
Thank you for that.
And a point of clarification, and I'm also one of your fans. That you spoke very eloquently to having a direct pay. Also, as I contemplate going forward and really developing this implementation policy, we would also, because again, it's an accountable plan, it just means we've got to have receipts submitted. So if, say, for instance, if a legislator wants to incur an expense that comes out of their pocket, they can then, you know, you don't get LAA to go pay the parking fees at the airport when you're traveling to Juneau. You don't direct bill those. You got to get, you know, you got to pay them, but it can be submitted for reimbursement as well.
Yes, and we get those reimbursements out as quick as possible.
And I would note that you do an admirable, frankly, an extraordinary job of that, considering the number of folks you're working with.
Mr. Chair,
if I could follow up.
I'll get Peter. You're next.
I do want to, you know, and I may not have been clear. I may have understood, but most of the people will do a direct bill to the state on your behalf. So you really don't have to do that transaction out of pocket unless it's small things. So on the big items, the mailing
right.
And so you don't necessarily have to submit your receipts. You can have them bill it. And once again, I applaud what you guys have done. And maybe if I call you with a vendor that, you know, they don't have a account, they can do the credit and make sure that they can do direct bill to the state. So once again, it's not that we have to pay to get reimbursed in everything.
Right.
In some cases, they can direct bill to the state. We have a pretty good credit in most cases. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And thank you, Representative Johnson. Would note, Representative Osterman has joined us online. Welcome, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, this is Representative Greenberg.
And Representative Pruitt. Senator Michiki?
This is Representative Gruenberg. I was asking.
Oh, I apologize. With the speakers, my chemified hearing sometimes doesn't distinguish the voice tones very well.
That's okay.
Representative Gruenberg, sir.
Thank you. This has been the, I'm going back to the practice before last year. And, excuse me, the practice always was that we got X dollars, $8,000 per year in the House, $10,000 in the Senate. We would submit bills, they would be paid, and then at the end of the year, the balance would be given to us as compensation and a check, and there'd be withholdings from that. And my recollection is that that was the practice ever since I was in the legislature in the 1980s. I can't swear to that, but it had been a long-standing practice. And I know that if this thing were in court, for example, and it's, you know, a type of administrative question, administrative law question, courts traditionally look at how the statute has been interpreted by the agency that's charged with administering that. And depending upon the technical complexity of the statute, the agency interpretation is on a sliding scale entitled to a great deal of weight or not much weight at all, but they certainly look at the way it has been interpreted, and it had been interpreted that way for a number of years. What I'm wondering, if anybody is there, either Ms. Varney or Mr. Gardner or somebody, anybody done any research to determine how long that had been the interpretation and whether there had ever been any alleged legal opinions on the subject.
Pam, do you want to respond to Representative Gruenberg? And Max, I just note that regardless of the history, we're making a policy call to go forward with today.
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, I do have a legal opinion from Doug Gardner and Emily Nauman, one of our attorneys. We have had the allowance go through a lot of different changes over the years. I mean, it started out at probably $200. It was $4,000 for many years. Then we did, and we used to just cut the check without any deductions. Then it went to accountable, non-accountable plan, and I'd be glad to share that legal opinion by legal with the council or any of the members if you would like to see it, or maybe Doug or Emily would like to comment.
Mr. Gardner?
Representative Gruenberg, through the chair, I guess I, if you could you give me your question again and give it to me so I can respond to it?
After listening to Ms. Varney, the question was, have there been any previous legal opinions on the subject? And I'm talking specifically on whether the statutes would allow, under the current wording and the agency interpretation, would allow the balance of the unexpended account to be paid directly to the legislator as taxable income.
Max, I'll answer that question. The answer is absolutely not. That is what that would cause. If we adopted, went back to that policy, it would cause every payment made to every legislator to be recharacterized by the IRS as taxable income, and quite frankly, it exposes us to having all that income over many years past recharacterized for the fact that we have not been doing this right, but in that it's a bit of a gray area, and the Legislative Council last year, as soon as they became aware, and I've got people back in the room taking notes, as soon as they became aware of the circumstance, they changed it to something fully allowable under the Internal Revenue Service statutes in full compliance with all the Internal Revenue Code and Internal Revenue regs and procedures. We cannot go back to that residuary concept.
I understand. Thank you.
Thank you, Max.
Representative Pruitt, sir.
Thank you. One statement and then just one question. The statement, actually, I was going to kind of tie on to Senator Myers over there. If there's anyone that needs more money, it's probably the new representatives and senators. As a newer senator or representative, I came in and I recognized that the office expenses of just getting your office up and running was actually rather high. Just I'm going to throw that out. I spent way more than my allotment that first year to try to communicate and to just, you know, and just the simple things, you know, getting all your, once you got all your letterhead and, you know, the appropriate TVs to watch Gavel Gavel down in Juneau, those kinds of things. So I just throw that out there as a guy that was fairly new and remembered that I was kind of recognizing the sticker shock there. The other question, though, that I have is, are there things, as we change to this, are there certain things that that some people may be currently maybe using their accounts for that they might not be able to do in the future? For instance, I think, is food fully reimbursable through the account? You know, a lot of people do their summer picnics. Are they going to be able to do that still?
We've always allowed food to be, oh, Representative Pruitt through the chair, we've always allowed food to be reimbursed at 50%, and we made that, we did that because that's the amount that's allowed to be deductible for business expenses on your income tax return. So that's how we came up with that amount. So it's 50%.
It's no longer, and this may be a question, if it's no longer a tax issue, would it potentially be possible that, because I know everyone does that in the summer, and they do it during the session. They'll go back, and if that's we deem that a legitimate business expense, is that something that we're going
to Representative Pruitt, I think this is also a very legitimate subject to take on as another step in determining what our account policy is, and this is why we now have for myself as chair, I've established this working relationship with Deloitte Tax on an ongoing basis to be able to take these sort of detailed questions to one of the leading tax accounting firms in the world.
Yeah, okay. And then I'll add one other thing that I think some people also utilize their accounts because some people do have at the end of the year some money, and they like to help out like some of their booster clubs and some of those things. Is that something that some of these individuals are going to be able to continue to do? Or is that something that will change with this?
We've not allowed donations out of the office accounts. The one caveat to that would be if there was advertising, if they were going to advertise on your behalf and they kind of called it a donation, but you were getting something in return. That was the big thing.
I appreciate it.
And again, that would be something that could be further clarified by an amendment of statute if we chose to. So we've got to look, if we look at this wonderful authorizing statute, I don't know quite when it was passed, but I don't know anyone that is spending money these days on stenographic services.
1959, I believe.
And Pam indicates that statute came into existence in 1959. So, again, it may be one of those things that it's time to review the overall substantive elements of this, which is separate than the compliance elements we're talking about today.
Yeah, I figure we'll have a lot of questions with the changes. We kind of... another thing I would definitely ask is let's stop changing this thing. Let's just set our policy and be through with it because it's incredibly frustrating. I mean, I've had three different things, and I've only been here 3 years, dadgummit. So let's just set it in stone. But I think there's going to be a lot of questions as we go forward. I'm really asking just so that as people start asking what's new, how are we going to be able to make sure that our members know what they're dealing with. So.
And Representative Pruitt, I agree with you completely. I understand the transition into the legislature for you young guys.
Yeah.
But very much so, this I'm intending as chair of this committee that we are establishing a policy that is durable. And whatever, there's so many areas within state statute that really does become arcane.
Yeah.
And perhaps this is one of those statutes that has become a bit arcane and it needs to be revisited. Representative Johnson, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I fully support what we're about to do. I also know that there have been a lot of areas, the food, for example, and I would encourage somehow an orientation. We could get everyone together because not everyone I know in the legislature is riveted to their TV sets watching us today.
Mm-hmm.
So if we could, either by memo mm-hmm. or by orientation,
you know, we don't want to create something that all of a sudden in a year someone says, well, gosh, I didn't know that, and they're faced with an ethics violation or something right. like that. So, you know, I think if people know the rules very clearly and they're very laid out, if they choose to violate them after that, then that's their own problem. I would hate for this council to be responsible for someone getting in trouble because the information wasn't imparted. So I encourage you in somehow orientation, and I'm going to leave that up to you as to how, orientation, written memo, that this new policy be very clearly outlined and the do's and the don'ts.
Definitely.
Be very clearly outlined. Because my concern is that because we have changed so many times, is what was 2 years ago wasn't good last year. What was good last year is not going to be good next year. So just be very clear on what we're about to do. I totally support what we're about to do, but I just want to make sure that we don't inadvertently get someone in trouble for lack of understanding.
Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Varney.
Thank you. And Representative Johnson, we can certainly work with Representative Hawker's office. Jessica has a great guidelines on the allowance account to make sure that working with the tax attorneys, we can look at that. And then also Jessica could have a brown bag luncheon or something where the members could be invited and staff to that session.
Continue, sir, please.
And I appreciate the brown bag lunch, but that appears to be voluntary. I would like something. I would like something that, at the end of the day, someone says, "I didn't know." We look them in the eye and say, hey, "That's your problem."
Noted.
You didn't attend a bragging battle lunch because you didn't read the stuff you were supposed to read when you came into work that day. So, a little more than that, I want a formalized approach, either in orientation, maybe in ethics training. I don't know how, where we work it, where you fit. I'm gonna leave that up to you, but encourage you to impart 60 bits of information accurately to 60 different people so they can disseminate it to their staff. So that's kind of my goal and mission here. Because we have changed it. It's been more than three.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's move on here. We're moving. Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I support the idea there, too, of making this as detailed as possible because it is confusing and a lot of the expense that we do have does pertain, unfortunately, to food, whether it be a picnic where we hire a caterer
mm-hmm.
or we take out a constituent and have lunch.
Right.
But also, too, I know there's a lot of times we had a constituent meeting not too long ago, and even the schools now will charge you rental to use the schools.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure if that's a legitimate expense under this or not. I know in my case, most of my expense, and like I said, almost all of my expense goes for mailers, and I'm pretty sure that's a legitimate expense. But if we want to buy back, let's say, a staff member for a constituent meeting during session,
mm-hmm.
Should we be using is that a state expense, or should we be using our POTA account, or is that one of those gray areas that we just have to decide?
Senator Meyer, through the chair, if it past procedure has been as if it's not approved by the presiding officers, then legislators could pay for that out of their office accounts.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that is a legitimate expense.
It is, yes.
Okay, well, I'm going to close debate on.
Actually, I would like to.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate you giving me the leeway to go ahead and speak, especially since we're trying to get through the agenda. But as you look at some of the issues that are out there, especially some of the issues that I face having looking here, and you look at the three options that are there, it's pretty obvious that number three is off the table, and I'm certainly not in favor of that. But as I look at the situation that I've run into in the past 13 years that I've been in the legislature having and looking at the case, I would say Senator Wilson is probably the only other one that has, and Senator Coghill has, a district that is larger than most people here that are here at the table. What I see is that having to go ahead and only have the one plan, which is dealing with the fully accountable plan, it causes me somewhat of an undue hardship because I've got to go ahead and start putting all these receipts together, send them on in, and because of my remote location, there's a time for reimbursement, and my credit card starts to accumulate up toward the amount of the limit. And not all those things that are on the credit card are really related to are going to be reimbursed. I understand that, but I'm talking about my ability to go ahead and get reimbursed for that. And as you look at that area, and let's face it, my area currently goes all the way from down just above Cordova all the way across the top half of the state, excluding Fairbanks and that area. So as pointed out by Senator Meyer, the mailings and just the ability to get out there are significant and certainly have gone over my account. And especially as we look at some of the staff travel, as we've been pointing out, and especially more in the past than under the current Senate President, when you're trying to get staff out there, especially in the situation like we had in Galena, where I couldn't get there right away, but a staff member could go on out there. You know, staff travel, they just said, go ahead and take it out of your office allowance, which doesn't go very far, and especially if you're trying to have to go ahead and pay for that with the idea that you're going to get reimbursed sometime in the near future. But I think the problem that I see especially is that in the district that I have, where legitimate receipts are at best not available, because people don't have credit card machines out there, and they certainly don't have, they're usually dealing with a cash basis. I feel like I'm being put at a disadvantage without having to go ahead and be able to subscribe fully to this plan that is in front of us, that everybody seems to be in favor of. As you look at the comment that Representative Pruitt talks about, the confusing thing happens to be with the accountant that I have, who lives here in Anchorage, does tax preparations for urban legislators as well as myself and rural legislators. It's so between the IRS regulation changes that are out there and the changes you're doing in the legislature, I don't know where you stand sometimes on some of these issues that are there. And I think to do away with the gray area, as was pointed out, and keep us away from ethics violations, to me, I see the easiest thing to do is to have option two, where you have the non-accountable plan for those legislators that want to go ahead and choose that. And I think that's the reason that it was put in place several years ago when the previous Lynch Council was here. So with all due respect, I think that there should be an option out there for those legislators that don't have the advantage of your biggest expense and travel expenses driving across town with a car where you've got cheap gas prices already. Because there are plenty of places out there in rural Alaska where I bought gas and they'd take cash and cash only and didn't have any receipts and certainly didn't have any credit card. So I feel like having to go back to the fully reimbursable plan is not something that I am in favor of, and certainly not my account.
Well, and I'd respond to that I think if we were a board of directors of a business sitting here, that is exactly the correct business decision that we could make, in that we have the overriding statute that authorizes these allowance accounts. I personally feel constrained to the first option of a completely accountable account by operation of statute. However, if that statute, as we talked about already, is arcane in any number of respects, if that statute was modified to recognize really contemporary legislative life, including the realities of Alaska here, and if it was modified in a manner that recognized that it could be a compensatory expense allowance structure, then I think allowing individual legislators their own choice would be a very good option. But again, where I've come back to personally on this is I don't see that there's a sufficiently clear legal authority for us to have any level of compensatory allowance at this time. But that's my own opinion, but that's why we're the policymaking body of the legislature here. And, you know, it is a policy call.
Mr. Chairman.
One last comment, Mr. Chairman, and I respect your professional opinion of what's going on, but from what I understand, there's not been a legal opinion that has given that same weight to your interpretation of what's there, and it's certainly not one that's been challenged anyway. As far as I know, it's never been challenged. And so because of that, I think that we're premature to try and make a decision at this point.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Because of what's been said, I think it would be wise for us to look at the statute and have someone be able to maybe see how we can tweak it so that it will reach everybody. But that would be something that we'd have to take care of right away at the beginning of the session, but I think that could be done. But
I hate to interrupt you, but you're making tax elections. They have to be made before the end of the year. Sorry to interrupt you.
Yep. Okay, well, just a thought.
And, Pam, I do believe we actually have had some level of legal look at this, but back in the previous legislative council, which I don't have in front of us at the moment, that also did conclude that it's legally unclear.
Yes, and the problem with the accountable plan that we had before is that the extra money was not, the excess was not returned to the general fund, and so you're fixing that today is the thing.
With that, I'm going to close the debate. We've got people with other meetings they've got to get to here. Representative Johnson, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me get my glasses out again. I would like to make a motion on what I'm going to call from now on the constituent services account. And I move that the allowance policy adopted by Legislative Council on December 13, 2012 be amended to be administered as a fully accountable plan for all legislators with any balance remaining at the end of the calendar year lapsing. And I'd be happy to present that motion in writing to the Secretary for my fumble.
She has a copy of the motion.
Thank you, Mr.
Okay, the question before the committee is adopting a fully accountable allowance plan for all legislators with a lapsing balance.
Mr. Chairman.
Secretary.
Representative Chenault. Representative Gruenberg.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Pruitt.
Yes.
Representative Stolt.
Yes.
Representative Wilson.
Yes.
Senator Huggins. Senator Coghill.
Yes.
Senator Dunleavy. Senator Egan.
Yes.
Senator Meyer.
Yes.
Senator Stevens. Vice Chair Machicki.
Yes.
Chair Hawker.
Yes.
Representative Osterman.
Yes.
And I would note, Representative Osterman, as an alternate, your vote is not necessary because we do have a quorum.
Yeah, well, don't call it then.
Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry, Madam Secretary.
Oh, I should not be counting his vote.
Please do not count Alan Osterman's, Representative Alan Osterman's vote.
Okay.
Not that we don't count Representative Alan Osterman.
Of course. We have 10 yeas and 0 nays.
So on a vote of 10 yeas and 0 nays, we've approved amending the policy. Pam, let's get together and get that amended.
Mr. Chairman.
Is that Senator Machicki?
It is. I was trying to cut in during the discussion, did not get an opportunity to chat. If I can make a very brief statement. And obviously, I voted yes in support of the accountable plan. Just want to make it clear: if some of us kept an accountable plan individually anyway, because of constituent questions about the previous system, and I just wanted to make the public statement for those of us with challenging districts. I mean, two of my communities require a boat ride. Or a flight, it's difficult, and you couple that with being a new legislator, and I just wanted to assure the public that $20,000 is not an adequate sum of money to cover a new legislator with a challenging district. So I just wanted folks to realize that it's expensive to do legislative business in the state of Alaska, and that it's not a large sum of money, even though it may sound that way to some.
Mr. Chair, may I ask a question? This is Representative Gruenberg.
Representative Gruenberg.
I believe we've gotten the money for this year already, have we not?
Yes, Representative Gruenberg, you received your check on the first day of legislative session.
So what do we do about this year?
Representative Gruenberg, the policy will be effective for the following and subsequent year, as we discussed earlier. It will be effective for the coming calendar year, which is how this account is administered.
And that's clear from the text of the motion, I take it.
And certainly now that it's on record with you.
Thank you.
Okay, well, moving on here, we've got a couple of, well, good to have you at the bench there. Pam, we've got a couple of regular contract approvals, the Barrow office lease and the Discovery Preschool contract renewal. Can you let us know what's going on there? And since I've lost Representative Johnson to this meeting, Representative Pruitt, do you have the motion sheet?
I can feel it.
Thank you. If not, I'll get you another copy. Good. Thank you. So, Pam, floor is yours.
Thank you. Before the council members is our Barrow sublease extension renewal number 3, and it is in the amount of $33,124.68, excluding CPIU adjustments. And Senator Olson and Representative Nagiak use our Barrow LIO, although it is my understanding that Representative Nagiak has office space not at this location, but they do use our services there. And maybe Senator Olson would like to speak to it, but I believe he's happy with our space.
Representative Olson. Excuse me, sir. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree with you that we do have the spot there. We actually, my office is just part of the conference room that's there because there is limited space up in Barrow at this time, but at least at this point, Representative Nagiak, I think, has all of the office space, whether it's at home or someplace else. So I'm certainly in favor of us continuing on with it.
And so the chair would entertain a motion. Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I move that Ledge Council authorize the chairman to approve a one-year renewal of the existing sublease agreement with Arctic Slope Telephone Association Cooperative, Inc. for the Barrow Legislative Information Office for a cost of $33,124.68.
So the question before the council is the extension and renewal of our lease with Arctic Slope Telephone and Association Cooperative, and as those of us that live up there call it, ASTAC, for the Barrow LIO. Madam Secretary.
Representative Chenault. Representative Gruenberg.
Yes.
Representative Johnson. Representative Pruitt.
Yes.
Representative Stoltz.
Yes.
Representative Wilson.
Yes.
Senator Huggins. Senator Coghill.
Yes.
Senator Dunleavy. Senator Egan.
Yes.
Senator Meyer.
Yes.
Senator Stevens. Vice Chair Maticki.
Yes.
Chair Hawker.
Yes.
9 yea, 0 nays.
So on a vote of 9 yea and 0 nay, the ASTAC lease renewal has been approved. Ms. Varney.
Next item on the agenda is Discovery Preschool LLC renewal. It is in its third and final one-year renewal with Discovery Preschool, and they have 39 spots for child care, and it serves year-round legislative employees, state and city employees. We also have 9 child care slots for legislators and legislative staff who relocate to Juneau for session. And in checking with the director, she has received 6 applications so far for those 9 spaces. And I'd be glad to answer any questions.
And I just was noticing there's no money associated with this?
There is no money associated. We do provide the office space, but the financial arrangements between the parents and the Discovery Preschool are between those two entities and not the Legislative Affairs Agency.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple questions. So do they pay us to lease that area?
No, it's run the same way like the federal building, in that the federal building provides the office space for their contract child care services, and we're doing the same thing in the Thomas Stewart building.
And is this, if I may, is this being run by a nonprofit or for-profit organization?
It is for profit. I think they haven't gone through the steps to do a nonprofit, but we have, in the years that they have been in there, we have not had any problems, and it's really provided a great service, not only to the parents coming down to Juneau trying to find proper child care for their children, but also for the community that, you know, has gone through a child care provider shortage.
Okay, because, Mr. Chairman, I know we've been buying additional space. We bought the church across the street, and I'm just wondering, should we be using that space instead of giving it away free to a for-profit group?
Well, it's providing a service that we really need to help, you know, make the parents that are trying to find child care so that they can go to work. We have a lot of extra space right now and cubicles set up in the gym since audit has moved out that we're going to use for the next couple years with our exterior remodel. But we do have extra office space right now on site.
And if I may, Ms. Chairman, I'm certainly sympathetic. I mean, I had both my kids down there when they were young, and we had to go all the way to the valley to find child care. So having it right there is certainly very convenient, but it is bothersome to me that we're out of space and we're buying up additional buildings when we have this area right there. And there has been, I'll have to tell you, Pam, some question about whether or not this is compatible with legislative duties in the sense that whether we like it or not, we have protesters in front of the Capitol, and sometimes they say and do things that maybe aren't appropriate for little kids to see. I know at times I know this has come up before where we've asked the protesters to leave because it's offensive to the little kids, but those protesters have rights too. So I just want to make sure. I mean, I appreciate the first. I just want to make sure everybody's rights are being protected here. At the same time, providing this daycare service because it is very important. And I also want to make sure that as we run out of space, that we look at all the alternatives. I think I'll leave it there, Mr. Chairman.
Well spoken, Senator Meyer. For the debate here, I get share your concerns. I'm inclined to actually on this one pull this from the agenda today for a little further consideration. Senator Meyer's raised some very good questions here that I think merit a greater debate, especially in that I've had some experience since I took over this chair with those issues of some legislators being concerned about the incompatible location. And I just wanted to ask, I've got a staff who has a young child that has been looked into these things, and Pam, I just was wondering, would there be consequences of not moving this or not approving this at this meeting?
Well, there would be in that it would expire the end of December, and so that would mean that 40 parents would need to find a place for their children to have child care provided.
Ms. Lucky?
For the record, my name is Julie Lucky. I'm staff to Representative Mike Hawker, and I am aware and sensitive to the issues that Senator Meyer has brought up. But as I know that the waiting list has already been put out for this year, and I would point out that this is the last year of the contract. So regardless of any action taken by the council today, in the upcoming year, we will either be going out for RFP or the contract will be expiring. And as a parent who has counted on this service before, and I know many parents who have and have already put their names in and are looking for that child care now, I would strongly urge that the council approve this today. We put it on the agenda. As it goes through, the contract will naturally expire next year if we take no action.
Senator Coghill.
I agree with Senator Meyer, and maybe with a year
coming out, maybe it would be a good idea to look at that appropriateness. We really ran into a snag last year, and it just didn't fit. And it created a really an untenable situation where people's freedom of speech was blocked in a significant way because it riled so many people. So it was just both inappropriate on both sides. And we certainly don't want to get caught in that snafu again. That was terrible. We really violated some people's rights to protect other people's rights, and it was just way off. So maybe there is better use of that space, and maybe we should look at other ways of doing it. So I was not coming here prepared to stop it, but I think the point is well brought up.
Representative Pruitt, sir.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it probably is not a good idea to necessarily stop it this coming year. I think we've kind of got an implied commitment that there will be space available for these children. Discussion next year at an earlier time might be warranted. What I also might suggest is just asking the Discovery preschool to maybe make sure that it's very clear with the children that are the parents that are there that before this coming session starts that they recognize that because of this place that it is that there could be certain protests or certain things that they may not necessarily agree with, but by having their children in there they are accepting whatever kind of adverse effects they may deem. That might be something that we may think about requesting of Discovery this year, but I don't know that pulling the plug this year, this soon, what we've implied that they'll be there, is necessarily the right direction. I think we probably should just go ahead and approve it today, but I agree it warrants a conversation into the next year because we did come across the scenario and the incompatibility of little kids being right next to some of the
politics of the street.
The joys of what we get to deal with.
The theater of the street. I've now called you a senator and a representative. Staff lucky.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would point out that Legislative Council did not actually get any comments or complaints from the director of the preschool or parents. I'm not sure if they might have called a representative or a senator and led to what the unfortunate incident that happened, but we did not get any complaints from the parents of the children there. We did not get any complaints from the director of the preschool. I am fairly sure that they are aware of the fact that there will be protests in front of the Capitol. They all are Juneau residents. That being said, I think that it does warrant, and I'm not trying to advise you guys on what you should be doing, but offering the contract to go through this year will allow the parents who already are counting, the staff members who are already counting on that child care to be there, I think is a good route forward, and we can definitely have this discussion. Like I said, the contract will naturally expire at the end of, this is the last renewal, so this will be a topic of discussion regardless of what we do today.
So, Pam, presuming we go ahead and approve this one-year role for the next, I would ask that LAA take the initiative and responsibility of coming back early in the next year with ups on this and get it before us as a discussion item.
I had to do that, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Meyer.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate that. Yeah, and I think we should be having this discussion in June or July, not November, and because I understand how difficult it is. Believe me, I've been daycare pretty much all their child years, unfortunately. But the other concern, other than the incident there with the protesters, it's just the traffic. You know, kids are going to be kids. They're going to run in, and there's a lot of cars coming and going at the Capitol. Granted, the problem is only about 3 months of the year, maybe four, depending on special session. It is a concern, and I don't know what happens if a child does get hurt. The state's on the hook, or if the for-profit daycare has full insurance, but I think it warrants more discussion if we're going to do this on a long-term basis. But for now, Mr. Chairman, I agree. We think we have to support current staff there. And I'm sure I've already made decisions for child care.
Before I go to Senator Cogfill here, is there anyone online that wishes to comment on this? Hearing none, Senator Coghill.
Probably logistically, the traffic between the right under the overpass there is really difficult. And so have you experienced, do we have any accidents there, number one? But it sure looks like parking and the slippery hill really would be a problem right in the middle of the legislature. Has that been pretty well handled? How's that work logistically?
Well, we haven't had any problems. We did try with the city to have to switch our loading zone to the other side of the street, but because at the top of the hill how they have the sidewalk and everything, they did not allow us to do that. So we did try to alleviate, you know, children crossing the street, but we did not get the okay from the city to do that.
Well, with that, I'll bring this to a vote. The question before the committee is the council authorizing the chairman to approve a one-year renewal of the existing profession. Wait a sec, did we get a motion? No, I didn't, did I?
I need to go ahead and make that motion.
Apologies. Representative Pruitt, sir, would you please take the floor?
Mr. Chair, I move that Legislative Council authorize the chairman to approve a one-year renewal of the existing professional service contract with Discovery Preschool, LLC.
So the question before the committee is the approval of the one-year renewal, which is the last renewal of the existing professional service contract with Discovery School, LLC. Madam Secretary?
Representative Chenault?
Yes.
Representative Gruenberg?
Yes.
Representative Johnson? Representative Pruitt?
Yes.
Representative Stoltz?
Yes.
Representative Wilson?
Yes.
Senator Huggins? Senator Coghill?
Yes.
Senator Dunleavy? Senator Egan?
Yes.
Senator Meyer? Senator Stevens? Vice Chair Michicki?
Yes.
Chair Hawker?
Yes.
Nine yeas and zero nay.
So on a vote of nine yeas and zero nays, we have approved the renewal of the professional service contract with Discovery Preschool, LLC. Brings us to the last item of, oops, I take that back. We have two more items on of agenda here. Attorney Gardner, are you available, sir?
I am, Representative Hawker.
Well, it's law time. Last Ledge Council meeting, we approved a suite of amendments to the legislature's procurement policy, which had been brought forward by our legal department and our procurement folks. Two of those amendments, number 7 and 10, were withheld at the request of Representative Gruenberg for some thought time and consideration. Representative Gardner, or excuse me, sir, Mr. Gardner, if you could explain briefly what those two amendments are, and then I'll ask Representative Gruenberg if he concurs with those amendments, and we'll open it back up for more discussion.
Certainly, Representative Hawker. Committee members, the two remaining amendments that were part of, as Representative Hawker described, the suite of amendments presented, procurement procedure amendments presented to council during the last meeting were held, and they were part of a package of amendments that our office has collected over a period of time, noticing issues that either changes in the law or areas where the procurement procedures are working less well than we'd like. We proposed two changes. One after the comments at the last committee meeting, I narrowed and provided to the committee that's proposed amendment number 7. The issue that the agency from time to time and legislative legal services presented with is, you know, we have a lot of, as you know, legislative information offices statewide. Those offices and the ownership of those buildings sometimes change hands. When they change hands in a simple sale, It would be beneficial to the private contractors that provide us with the space, the lessors, if you will, to be able to have the chair of Ledge Council. I think is this what this would this amendment would primarily deal with. It would allow a fairly quick and responsive assignment of that leased space where there's no subordination agreement. And in cases like the one that the committee dealt with during the last committee meeting where there is a subordination agreement, in other words, where there are banks and lenders involved, that would still continue to require legislative council approval in a meeting like this. But where it's a simple assignment, where someone sells a building to another person and the other person just buys it outright, there's no banks involved, I think it would be very helpful to the lessors out there in Alaska that provide us with the space to have a quick assignment through the committee. And this amendment would allow that narrow assignment authority. And since Ledge Council deals with most of the space leases throughout the state, this would primarily just involve this committee. So that's the amendment number 7 that's presented for council members' consideration. Representative Hucker, do you want me to pause to see if there's a question or just roll into amendment number 10?
Why don't you go right to number 10 and then we'll throw it to questions.
Sure. Some time ago, I hope members have had a chance to take a look at the footnote at the bottom of proposed amendment number 10. Much of that footnote was added as additional explanation since the last meeting to assist you in making your choices. Right now, the legislative procurement procedures don't limit a potentially successful bid protester to their bid preparation costs. The AS 3630, which addresses procurement for the executive branch, does have that limitation. As you can see from the discussion that was pulled from 1996 when this limitation was placed in 3630, it's designed to protect the legislature from a large damage claim or some other claim that goes beyond bid preparation costs. And this is one area where it seems reasonable for the legislature to treat its procurement procedure the same as the executive branch and limit somebody who does present a successful bid protest to their costs, to what it costs them to apply for the particular contract. So this is an effort to make the legislative procurement procedures consistent with AS 3630, and I won't add more, but we'll respond to any questions.
Mr. Gardner, Rep. Hawker here, and again, this is repeating what you just said. This is conforming the legislative procurement policy to that is established by statute for the administrative branch, and our legislative procurement branch is our legislative procurement policy is established under a separate statute, but that statute really directs us to be consistent with the statutory policy established for the executive.
I think that's a fair summary, yes. It's a consistency issue.
Thank you. Representative Gruenberg, your comments on these two amendments now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've looked at both of them, and I had asked to have them held so that at least I could review them. I'm satisfied that they're good amendments for the reasons that Doug Gardner has said. And I would simply add that with respect to amendment number 7, I just didn't know enough about it to really want to vote on it last time. So it wasn't anything specific that I was concerned about. On the other hand, with respect to amendment number 10, I was concerned about why should damages be limited to such a small sum. And my research in what Mr. Gardner has said is that the situation in a bidding process with the state, regardless of whether it's legislative or executive, is not the same as a suit for damages. If it's a contract action, obviously you could get all kinds of additional
actual general, special, and consequential and incidental damages, maybe even punitive. But that's not the way these proceedings work when you're in a bidding situation, a procurement situation. You're not seeking damages. What you're seeking is generally to have the process made right or have the contract award vacated or whatever. And it's not just for money damages, and there may be two innocent parties really involved, the one who got the bid and the one who didn't get the bid. And the fault is through neither, but it may be through the government in the process itself. So it's not exactly the same thing. And in the executive branch, the way it has traditionally worked is it's more of an equitable remedy you get. They either have the thing redone or have additional points given to somebody or deducted or something like that. And so getting additional damages really doesn't get either the parties or the system or the government to the position they should be in to be made whole. And that's why a Title 36 has been limited in this manner, and that's why it's appropriate that we amend this statute, this procedure accordingly. And I therefore I support both amendments.
Thank you, Representative Gruenberg. Further comments from the committee? Hearing seeing none, I'll entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move that Ledge Council adopt proposed amendments 7 and 10 to the legislative procurement procedure as presented.
The question before the committee is the adoption of proposed amendments 7 and 10 to the legislative procurement procedure. Madam Secretary.
Representative Chenault. Representative Gruenberg.
Yes.
Representative Johnson. Representative Pruitt.
Yes.
Representative Stoltz.
Yes.
Representative Wilson.
Yes.
Senator Huggins. Senator Coghill.
Yes.
Senator Dunleavy. Senator Egan.
Yes.
Senator Meyer. Senator Stevens. Vice Chair Michicki.
If he fells off, I'm in trouble.
Senator Michicki.
Yes.
Thank you. Chair Hawker.
Yes. Madam Secretary, announce the roll.
Eight yeas and zero nays.
On a squeaker vote of eight yeas and zero nays, the council has approved amendments number 7 and 10. Thank you.
Apologies, Mr. Chair.
Okay, the last bit of our agenda does not require a quorum, whether people have to take off or not here, but we had Senator Michicki had requested and was expressing concerns about a history of change orders on legislative projects, and Senator Michicki has completed that, provided a written report to the committee. And Senator Michicki, I would give you the floor.
Okay, I'm just going to summarize the letter. You all have it before you, but for the public, at the July 30th meeting,
Ledge Council members expressed concerns at the number of change orders associated with various projects, and I'm, you know, I share the concern. I expect and demand project efficiency, so I offered to review the change orders and report back, which is what we're doing today. On October 29th of this year, I met with Don Johnston and Pam Varney, and we discussed in detail the various remodel projects through the years and every change order. And over the last 28 years, they've tackled many projects. Recently, in addition to the Capitol, they've been responsible for three of the four building remodel projects, the Terry Miller, Thomas B. Stewart, and the Ledge Finance Building. And as you know, legislative audit was responsible for the sixth floor remodel in the state office building. So of the four projects, they were handled in two different ways. Were either an invitation to bid for external contractors or through a more internal process using the Capitol Building Manager as the general, which, if you look at the data as we get to the second page, provided some savings. They also handled procurement using two methods. One was approval for the total amount from the council for the project at the beginning of the project. The second method required council approval for every item over $25,000 or 10% of the original amount of the construction project. So just for a brief summary of the projects on change orders, the ledge audit remodel, three funding change orders totaling $316,000, which is 20% of the total project cost. Terry Miller, $243,000, approximately 7% of the total project cost. Thomas Stewart, 25 funding change orders, $265,000, approximately 5% of the total project cost. And legislative finance, there were six funding change orders totaling $70,000, or about 9.5% of the total project cost. And two of those six change orders were not code compliance issues. So as a legislature, you know, we're here to ensure responsible and transparent spending of the state dollars that we're entrusted to be watchful over. And it's important that we take the time to understand significant expenditures and change orders. However, I do think we need to focus. I personally have some experience on large projects, and there should be a realization that these projects in question are certainly less typical on buildings that are very much advanced in age and often behind in modern code compliance, which the majority of the change orders are associated with project tasks that would have been difficult to identify in advance. So if you take that into consideration, I'm just here to say that I personally feel that the Legislative Affairs Agency has followed the legislative procurement policies and the direction of the Legislative Council during the process of completing some fairly difficult projects outlined above. And again, we're charged with responsible fiscal management of the legislative projects. In the future, unless we choose as a council to look at approving project costs up front or putting additional contingency funds into the contract structure, I think we'll be charged with continuing to include approving each change order item that exceeds $25,000 or 10% of the original amount of the construction contract. Personally, I believe that second set of watchful eyes is imperative to a robust public process and support that process, but I also don't feel that we should sort of rake LEA over the coals every time there's a change order. I enjoyed the process of completing this report. I have background information of the change orders attached to the packet. We did investigate other states. Who've been sort of slow to respond, but we did find some states generally have a higher amount of change order that needs to be approved by alleged counsel. I think it was Idaho is $100,000, and we're still looking for other information. So that concludes my report. Other than questions, I'm available for that, and Mr. Johnston and Pam Varney are available as well.
Well, thank you, Senator and Vice Chair Michiki here. Very much appreciate the time and effort you put into this, which is obviously substantial. Questions from the committee for Senator Michiki?
Just gratitude. I think that was very well done, and I appreciate them digging into it. The extra eyes were nice, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Coghill.
Thank you, Senator.
Well, with that, unless we have anything more to be brought before the committee, so members present, hearing see none. Members online, is there anything else to bring before the committee?
Thank you, Mr.
Hearing see none, we'll stand this meeting in adjournment.